mean, or angry things. Tears of, okay, selfish, grumpy. That's really selfish and grumpy is kind of, that's a, you know, that's redundant. Yes. Unteachable. All right, good. All right, yeah. Hungry. Yeah, I was going to ask, okay, the next part of this is not just what you're like when you're grumpy, but when do you get what we call grumpy? What are the condition that produces this attitude? Yes? When corrected by your parents, you get instantly grumpy. Yes? Okay, when you're not around people much, then, yeah, she's like, oh, that's right. Annika's like, where are the people? I'm grumpy, all right? When you lose a video game, or maybe when you lose anything, all right, or the thing that matters to you. Tired. Tiredness seems, or we make the excuse, that it produces grumpiness. Kind of like a virus produces a sickness, we often use tiredness as an excuse for grumpiness. When you don't get your way, right? I'm almost always, you get grumpy. Yes, anyone else? That was like 3 people had their hands up for that one. Hungry, like as Andrew said, all right? I tend to use also hunger as an excuse to be irritable. Headache. Oh, yeah, when you're not feeling physically well, right? Maybe you have a headache or some physical sickness, all right? We tend to use that as an excuse. All right, now, when things, yes, sorry, Tristan. Okay, right, yeah, so you just kind of, and somebody says something, like, and you snap at them, yeah, Ronnie. Before you have coffee. All right, which is like tiredness, achiness, feeling sick, all that together, right? And then you have coffee and what? Everything magically is fine, all right? You can talk to people. There are people that they say, they'll walk around with a coffee cup, and like, don't talk to me, I haven't had my coffee. As though the magic elixir produces spirituality. It's amazing, all right? Now, I'm sympathetic. I'm totally sympathetic, all right? And usually it's just a joke, but not always. Yes. Right, we haven't eaten, right? Hungry, all right. Guys. The times when we get, think about this, the times when we get what we call grumpy, which I would call a condition of sinful selfishness in which we focus on ourselves to the detriment of others, or really we sin against others because of our sinful selfishness, grumpy. We might also call it complaining or grumbling. We don't like to use the word grumbling because that's got bad, you know, spiritual connotations, like, well, we don't want to grumble like Israel did and they were destroyed by the destroyer. We don't want to go there. We call it grumpy because grumpy sounds like an old man who just is like, oh, I'm grumpy, right? Or maybe, you know, a little like Barney when he's sad, all right? You guys know who Barney is. He's like, he doesn't even exist anymore. You guys, grumpiness, we're gonna use the term grumbling and complaining, and really it fits directly into our text because James is going to challenge us tonight, as he has been, not only to not complain against each other, but not to complain against the Lord, to get grumpy towards God. That sounds kind of puts grumpiness in its right place, like grumpy towards God. I mean, you can't even put those words together because when you do anything towards God, it's a lot more serious, right? So we would call it complaining, being selfish, talking back and murmuring to God. And those things happen to us, you guys, when life brings difficult things. And how often does life bring difficult things? Like all the time. Hungry, tired, discouraged. I get grumpy when I'm discouraged, when I fail at something. That's probably the time I get most what we would call grumpy or sinfully focused on myself is when I fail and then I take it out on everybody else. It makes it worse. So I fail, and sometimes I really did fail miserably, and then I sin against everybody else as I take it out on them, like I'm going to make you pay for my failure. So guys, it's a disgusting thing when we constantly cause others to pay for the difficulty, the wrestles that we are having with life circumstances, because that's the way it is all the time. And most specifically, we are most easily moved in this selfish, complaining, murmuring mode when other people are not treating us as we would have. Many of you mentioned that. When your parents tell you something you don't want to hear, when you know maybe you're confronted with something that you don't want to have to deal with, when others around you are not responding the way that you want, it's relationally that we tend to get most grumpy or most complaining, most murmuring. So I want to finish out James's challenge here, and I want you to keep that in mind. This is not for other people. You know, the come now you rich, weep and howl was like, well, you know, you could become that. Probably most of you are not that. Some of you may be, but none of you probably to that extent. But man, when it comes to be patient, don't complain, verse 9, in suffering and patience, follow the example of those who didn't murmur against the Lord, who didn't grumble back at him. Because that's all of us. And he's speaking to believers. speaking to the church. Again, the rich in verses 1 through 6, most likely they might have been in the church, but they were unbelieving. Because most of you are believing, or at least many of you. And yet we constantly make excuses for our grumbling in difficult circumstances. And yet, guys, somehow thinking that maybe your life will stop being difficult. When is your life going to stop being difficult? Never. It's never. It's always going to be difficult. So are you always going to grumble? We tend to think, well, if this thing ended, I'd stop grumbling. If my parents just let me do this. No, the very next thing you're going to be grumbling about. If I just got this, I would stop grumbling. No, the next thing you get, you're going to grumble about that. In fact, when you get the thing you want, you're going to grumble because it wasn't right. Think about our weather. All right? It's raining, and we're like, it's raining all the time. It stops raining, we're like, man, it's so hot. It never rains. Right? It's hot. It was hot in May. Man, it's so hot. Now it's cool, but the moment, so cold. Can't go out and do what I'm. Guys, we are inherent grumblers. And those things may be less important than some. I think it just reveals to us, think of how much easier it is for you to grumble when people in your life are difficult. And I want you to think about and wrap your mind around the fact that that's a lack of faith in God. That's the issue. When we grumble about anything, we are not trusting God. When we murmur and complain, we're not being patient. This biblical word, to have endurance under difficult circumstances. We start grumbling right away. I mean, how long does it take you to grumble? It's instant. Your parents do something you don't like, wham! Your brothers and sisters do something you don't like, instantly. You didn't get what you wanted. Guys, and you're not alone. I'm the same. It comes so quickly, and yet we're to have patient endurance to trust the Lord and honor the Lord, and we're to look at the biblical examples of those who made it through difficult things, continuing to trust in God. It's a test of your faith. It may even demonstrate to you that you are not a believer at all if you are grumbling and complaining constantly, if that characterizes your life. And for some of you, you might be like, whoa, are you sure? As I'm sure. Again, there's levels and stages of grumbling. There's, you know, things you. But you guys, if that characterizes your life with a constant grumbling and complaining, it may mean that there's not true faith. Because that's what the world does. Is the world ever satisfied with anything? No. Doesn't matter who we elect for the next president, guys. It does not matter. Somebody, everybody, is going to grumble about something. It does not matter how our political system changes, how your economic system changes. Somebody is going to grumble. Well, let's review where we've been on this test of patient endurance. This patience, the word patient here used again, for difficulty in circumstances with people, and certainly can also include difficult circumstances in general. He says, first, the command was, be patient, brethren. And remember that that was in light, most likely, of direct persecution by the rich. I mean, you think you have it bad now. Imagine if all the rich people in Maryville were coming after you, right? And were taking your stuff, and were abusing you, and were putting you to work because you didn't have enough money, and then weren't paying you. Right? We're dragging you into court when they could you know, find something against you to try to take your stuff. Now, have we seen some examples of that happening in our country? We have. And that will probably be increasingly more so. But you guys, nothing like when you live in Iran, or live in Iraq, or live in Syria, or live in China, or a place where there's true persecution. And so in light of the strongest persecution, he says, be patient, brethren. And he says, I love this, be patient for how long? How long should this hold on? What's the text say? Be patient, brethren, until... What's it say? Just say it out. The coming of the Lord. Now, there's two issues with that, remember. That could be as, well, certainly it's as long as the Lord waits. And since the time James wrote this book, how long has that been? About 2,000 years. Okay? So that's a long time. Yet, the flip side of that is, it could be and could have been for James at any moment. So there's this constant anticipation, and yet there's an understanding that it may be all of your life. That the Lord may not return. And so you're patient, not till some circumstance changes, not till some relation. Man, when I get married, I'll stop grumbling. All right? Well, no, believe me. that will not happen. All right? But nonetheless, it's not a circumstance. It's not, if I just had some friends, then I would stop grumbling. No, you just grumble about your friends. I guess it's not a circumstance. It's not people. It's not a stage in life. Man, when I'm 18, when I'm out of the house, when I go to college, I mean, pick it, when I get my car. You could name it. Those are not the things it says to wait for. It says be patient when? Until the coming of the Lord. Until you go to be with Jesus. We are to be patient. In spite of difficulty and suffering, this is from last week, so the command to be patient, in spite of difficulty and suffering, and remember he says we do this as a family, you remember that? He says, be patient, brethren. I love that. James always appeals, and the apostles always appeal not just to one individual. Right? They do sometimes do that, but it's always in the context of to a congregation. Brethren, how sweet is it when all of you stop grumbling? Oh, now let me think of a time when we're all going to be together for a long period of time when you might be considering grumbling. When might that be? Next week. And what would be things? Let me just ask this. This just comes to mind. This sounds good. What would be some things you might grumble about at camp? Yes, Marie. It's too hot. Actually, it's supposed to be like 82 degrees. We've never seen 82 degrees on camp except when it's pouring down rain in Ohio. All right? And we see lightning, thunder, and people coming by in boats. All right, that's about the only time. But if it were 82 or 83, I'd be like, incredible. But it's still going to be too hot. I'm going to be too hot. All right, so we could grumble about the heat, yes. We might complain about the rain. It looks like it's supposed to rain all week long. Hey, we're in cabins. We're still going to complain. All right, yes, Rebecca. Too tired. We do too much around here. Yeah, Levi. Hungry. And you won't, that's the one thing you will not complain about. No, you will. You'll eat your full meal and you're like, I'm so hungry. Alyssa. I got to get up early, do Devo. Some of the mornings, real early. All right, yeah, Carson. Yeah, all over and over and over. Whoa, all right, we're going to have some work with Carson. Yeah, Jen. Yeah, annoying people in your cabin. Oh, none of you are going to have annoying people. Look around, yes. The food might not be good. Couldn't happen, but somebody will find something to complain about. The lesson, I didn't like it, it wasn't long enough. No, probably not that. All right. Okay. Yes, Joanna? The cabins themselves, maybe they're musty, maybe they got mold in them. I don't know, probably. Yep. That's right. We got to go to bed now. Some of you, why aren't we going to bed already? All right. Now, Marie already had one, so you don't get another one. Daniel? That's right. I didn't get on the boat, or I had to leave the boat earlier. I didn't get to get knocked off on the tube, or I mean, you name it. Yes, Ronnie? Not having coffee. They don't ever let us have coffee, those mean, nasty leaders. Yep. By the way, well, I won't go into it. I could launch into a whole thing on camp, but I'm not. All right, yes. Not being able to stay the whole week. So, okay, guys, did you hear all those things? And that wasn't even all that could be. Imagine what would happen. It's as you guys began to think about complaining, that as a group, you exerted this really wonderful, positive, biblical peer pressure on one another to say, man, let's not grumble at all this week. You didn't mention like grumbling about the leadership, grumbling about them telling you to do things that you shouldn't or that they think you shouldn't do. Guys, it's going to happen almost assuredly to at least one of you or probably more. And you're going to be, I don't agree with that. Okay, what are you going to do? Right? Because there's lots of things you don't agree. So guys, so many things. If we just exerted a positive biblical pressure, is probably the wrong word, just encouragement on one another, that as a family, we wouldn't complain. Not only about circumstantial things, but about relational things. Because you guys get together for about 3 days. Okay, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, you're kind of feeling each other out. Thursday, the gossip hits. Now, probably sooner. You're talking about people in this camp. Talking about people that are doing this. You're like, ooh, do you know us? Yes, I do. And yes, I've been on camp. And do I love you? Yes. And is it all bad stuff? Not all. But you know what happens. And all of a sudden, you're starting to talk about one another. And talk about other people. And if you were to, and usually it's negative. You rarely, probably don't sit in your cabins going, maybe you do. Man, those three people in that cabin over there, they're awesome. Let's talk about how awesome they are. They told me this, and it was great. They told me this. Oh, so good. Probably doesn't happen that way. It might, and if you do that, that'd be cool. In fact, you write little notes to the other cabin. You guys are so awesome. We can't even walk by you without wanting one to bow down. Okay, don't make it ridiculous. But you guys, just think about it. If instead of the negative things, guys, it's our sinful selves that do that, right? Any group of people getting together for any amount of time is gonna do that if they're not careful. Maybe this would be the most amazing week ever, when things were hard and difficult, which they will be, when your will gets crossed, which it will, either by me or Rob or just some other teen or your cabin leader, that you would say, you know what, I'm gonna take that to the Lord. And then we're going to carefully help each other. Not foolishly, self-righteously. Chris said, you shouldn't complain, and I'm more spiritual than you, so stop. That's not really going to help anything. All right. Maybe just coming alongside, saying, "Hey, let's look at the scriptural side of this. How should we respond to this?" And encouraging each other and doing this, guys. That's what we do as a family. And by the way, it's one of the main reasons we do camp. It's because we want you to learn how to do that, and learn how to be, have your wills crossed a little bit, and do that in a youth group, a Christian setting. You get the plenty at home, I get that. But when we come around together so you can see how each other are responding and you can encourage each other, it's kind of a spiritual temperature check of the youth group whenever we go to camp. And the leaders always come back and we check the temperature. They're like, "Ooh, don't know." Right? Well, wow. So my prayer is that this might be a neat time. Now, again, people are going to sin. I get that. There's unbelievers going to camp most likely, and so they're going to wrestle. And you're going to love them and care for them. But you guys, that we would take this time as a family. Now, of course, we're together all year. We're together as a church. It's not as intensely usually. And so, guys, might this be a time to practice this coming together? And isn't it easier to stop complaining when people around you aren't? Isn't it easier to stop complaining when people graciously help you, not self-righteously, confront you? Although sometimes, usually anytime you get confronted, you think the other person's self-righteous. Just how it works. All right, so instead of doing that, just think, "Oh, that's not self-righteous, that is righteous confrontation." But anyway, guys, it's so helpful. So the command to be patient in spite of difficulty and suffering as a family, and then the length is till the coming of the Lord. The length of patience be, we do this until the coming of the Lord. Hey, if the Lord were to come back during camp, that would be the one way that we would have, no complaining. We go there on the first day, and boom, he comes back. Then we're done, nothing to complain about. It is true that in heaven, now this is sweet, in heaven, will there be any complaining? No, there can't be, because complaining, and as we're defining it here, is sin. Again, I'm not just talking about, it's not a sin to say, I wish it were cool when it's hot. That's not sin. The sin is when we really start to get angry at the Lord or angry at others, or we lose our contentment because of those things. Just saying those things isn't sinful. But letting them drive our lives to sinful behavior is. In heaven, think about it. There will not ever, for the rest of eternity, be one complaint. Sin will be gone. Right? And there will be no, we say there's no suffering, no crying, no sickness, no death. Yeah, no complaining. Maybe that's going to be the greatest thing about heaven. Nobody will ever complain again. Well, the courage of patience. What does he say in verse 8? Or the end of, she says, "You too be patient, strengthen your hearts, for the coming of the Lord is near." You guys, take courage. God is coming, and he could come at any time. He's not going to leave you here forever, even if it's a long time in earthly years. How long is it compared to eternity? It's really short. But you have need of courage. I was reading an article yesterday about the weakness of the American church. Why? Because we have things easy in our circumstances. We aren't persecuted like so many others are. We can kind of drink from the well of all these different, streams of thought because we've got the internet and all this stuff, and the church tends to be very weak. And we don't have people that have courage anymore. They won't stand up against the culture. They won't say to an unbelieving world, "No, that's wrong." Or, "No, that doesn't even make sense." Or, no, I'm not going to listen to you. I've the God of the universe to listen to." They start saying, "Well, you shouldn't listen to your parents." "Oh, yeah, maybe I shouldn't listen to my parents." And the Bible's, just a foolish little, "Oh, okay, maybe that's true." And maybe God didn't really create things. Oh, yes, we need courage. Not to complain, courage to stand against our culture, which constantly wants the next best thing, and instead to wait for the Lord. And that's what, guys, that's what I love to see in you. I'm telling you, it takes some courage to step away from other things and minister to little children for a week. It takes courage. Right? To say, I'm gonna, it takes moral and internal fortitude to move against what might be your natural desire, to say, "I'm just going to pour out my life to do that." Everything you do that's biblical takes courage. And we are a church that needs more courage. I love to watch you guys do that. And I would say I would commend you in many ways. And I think many of you, and as a group, you're a courageous group in many ways. Because we need more courage. We need to stand more strongly, and we need to do it together. Imagine how strong we are when we stand together. Then the kindness of patience. That's where we are now. We're picking this up. Now we're onto new stuff. The kindness of patience, verse 9. Because, and these all fit right together. Because when things get difficult, when things are hard, when we're persecuted, and in America, though, we don't have a lot of persecution, just when we're uncomfortable, when things don't go our way, who's the first people we turn on? One another. He says, "Do not complain, brethren, against one another. Right? It's a strong word, to sigh, to groan, to grumble. Oh, I can't believe you're like that. You know, I can't believe you did that. Why? This complaining that we have towards one another. It says, do not complain. And notice he says, as a family, stop complaining about each other. Your parents ever told you that? Stop fighting with your brother. Of course they have it, if you have a brother, right? 1,000 times, maybe more. Stop grumbling about your siblings, right? 100 times, if not 1,000. So in a family, and what do they tell you? They sit you down, they have the little talk, right? Or maybe the really long talk. They say, remember, we're a family. And so we're supposed to love one another. And I want you to look in Billy's eyes, and I want you to say, I'm sorry, I love you. Whatever it is, they make you do that, right? And then you have to hug. And so the hug is like this. You try not to touch them. You're like, I'll hug you. Okay? And so it's oftentimes not a heart thing. But your parents were trying to communicate to you that you're going to be with, you're going to have a relationship with this other person. They're going to be a blood relative all your life. You can't escape them. Even if you move away, when you get back for a reunion, they're still there. At Christmas time, they're there. Why? Because they're your blood relatives. They don't like take their DNA out. No, I'm not in this family anymore. No, they're going to be with you. And so they're trying to explain that, and you tend to be too short-sighted to see it. And you chop up those relationships that are so valuable, and instead you tend to value other things. Well, it works the same in the church, but even more so. This is the group of people, everyone who's a believer here, that you are going to know for your entire eternity. That's not guaranteed for everybody in your family. If they don't know Christ, you'll only know them for now. Because this is the group. Don't chop up these opportunities. Don't complain, brethren, against one another. Don't murmur, don't grumble, don't gossip. Don't express anger, inappropriate, sinful anger. Don't manipulate. All of these things that we do, do not complain. Because really when we're doing that, we're grumbling at God. God, why didn't you put me in different circumstances? Why didn't you give me different friends? Why didn't you give me a different church? Church is hard, isn't it? I mean, you hang around your buds, and it's cool. That's easy, because you just gather around a bunch of people that are just like you. And you don't have to deal with little kids. You don't have to deal with elderly people. You don't have to deal with teens that have nothing in common with you, zero, except the age. They don't like to do what you like to do. They don't want to be where you want to be, as far as just natural things you do. And you have to deal with them. You got to love them in the church. See, outside of that, that's why your family's hard, too. You're stuck with people that you didn't choose. This guy was born. I didn't choose him. Sorry. Well, the church works pretty much the same way. Because who chose the church? Parents chose it. And what'd they say? You go here. With this group of people? Right? Yeah, you're stuck. But you guys, that's the nature of it, that we're put together with people that it's hard to love, because we can't just create our own little perfect atmosphere, that we just get to choose the people we think are really cool. This is what happens when you go off to college. Oftentimes, people go off to college, like, man, it's so cool here. Everybody here is cool. They all look like you, sound like you, and you just gather around yourself on that college campus of people you really like. And then you got to go to church. People who are not cool, they don't do cool stuff, they don't like my music, they don't like any music, they like hymns. You see what I mean? Guys, you got to love the church. And these are the people you're going to be with, so don't complain. Don't complain about the elderly of the church. Why are they like that? Or why are they like that? Why don't they do this? Or so-and-so. Don't complain against each other. Do not complain. Why? Because these are the people that the Lord has put you with sovereignly, directing that you love this group of people. And I say it a lot, but I will say it again. I mean, do you think that somehow you're going to find a perfect church where it's easy to love people? That the people are easier to love? No, they're all just like this. Right? Once you get to know them long enough. See, people go on mission trips, they're like, now that church, we're going to go to Memphis. We're going to go to Jordan Thomas's church. And he's an awesome pastor. I'm sure he's got a sweet congregation. We're going to be like, now there's a cool church. If I could just go to that church, then everything would be great. And you go to that church, and in 6 months, you'd be like, where's my church? Or actually, you might not be. You're just like, let me find the next church, because that wasn't as cool as I thought it was, because they're sinners here. Because we don't complain against people, not because they don't sin against us, not because they aren't hard. We don't complain because we trust God that it will give us the strength to love them. And that's what we ask. Think about it. It is your primary job to do what? To love other people, to not complain. It's your job. It's what you do. It's not like Christians do something else and then occasionally they love people. What does the Bible say? You will know they are Christians by what? By their love. That's what John says. The book of John says, you will know by their love and their unity. By that litmus test, If a new person who'd never been to our youth group, never been to our church, went to camp with us, would they think we were Christians? Now, I think they would. But some of you might be thinking, not if they hang around the group I'm in. Well, that's not a good thing, right? So would they know you are Christians if they never had seen anything about you at all, and they showed up and they went to a week of camp with you? See, they could show up on a Wednesday night and they might think that. Unfortunately, maybe they wouldn't, even showing on a Wednesday night. But again, I think they would. You guys are a nice group of young men and women. And generally, I see you be kind and gracious to one another. I generally see that. And you go get people when they're not sitting next to you, and you say, come sit with me. And man, that is awesome. You throw the Frisbee to people that you don't want to throw the Frisbee to sometimes. All right? Because I think people might think that. But a whole week of camp? How about a whole year with you? So think about it that way. Would they know you are a Christian because you're not complaining against others? You're patient, you're waiting, you're kind, you're gracious. Galatians 6:9, let us not lose heart in doing good, for in due time we will reap if we don't grow weary. I wonder if maybe you came into the youth group at 7th grade, 8th grade, and pumped up about youth group, and maybe just pumped up about the Lord and excited to be here. And you were trying to love people, and they didn't love you very well. And by about 9th grade, 10th grade, you're weary. And you know what? It's time to be gone. I can't wait. You know, 11th grade, 12th grade, can't wait to hit the door. I'm weary of doing good. It's just really hard here. Might be really hard here. Don't grow weary. Why? If the farmer gives up on his crops halfway through the year and digs them up and plants something else and does that every 6 months, what happens? He never gets a harvest. Don't give up. It says, don't lose heart, for in due time you'll reap. And that farming metaphor again, in due time, at the right time, you'll reap if you don't grow weary. Some of you, probably all of us, you need more courage relationally. Some of you may like, jump off a cliff, throw myself in front of a train to save somebody, I'd do that in a second. But be kind and gracious and gentle to the person sitting next to me? Nope. See, we need more courage relationally. To not grow weary, you need stamina. Some of you are, you know, you're athletes, and you know that in order to get better at something, you have to grow in your ability to have endurance when you are lacking oxygen. I'm a runner, and so the key thing in running is the ability to continue to operate at maximum capacity as your oxygen diminishes, because it does. As your body tires, it uses more of the oxygen. The faster you go, the more it's using. And the key to any athletic endeavor in that sense is that you have to be able to grow weary more slowly. And the people who grow weary slowly win races, and the people who grow weary easily lose them. You guys, in a much bigger picture, much more important picture, not growing weary means you reap. You reap the benefit of a beautiful, strong relationship, but it takes time. We've got some young marrieds here. We've got a lot of young marrieds that seem to be springing up out of the church. Wonderful. You know what? The litmus test of their marriage is not the honeymoon week. And they're probably glad for that. Or maybe thinking, no, I wish it was just like that. That was awesome. However it goes, guys, the litmus test of their marriage is reaping 20 years from now. I'm going to celebrate 30 years this year. In fact, good heavens, it's coming up in like a week and a half. We don't get to celebrate. We never celebrate in June because we're always at camp or somewhere else. So we say, no, we're going to celebrate in August. And my wife has been very gracious to do that nearly every year. I think probably every year of our marriage of 30 years, I would say except two or three, we've been doing a youth activity or function or church activity or function on our anniversary. I think that's sweet. My wife has not always thought that was so sweet. So learning to plan ahead of time to say, hey, we're gonna take August. We're going to take the last 2 weeks of August. Because I tell you, the benefits of our relationship have not been reaped in the first 2 or 3 or 5 or 10 or 15 or 20 or 25 years. We are reaping now after 30 years the fruit of hard work. And we're not done. There's much more. Because relationally in a church, you stay in a church 2 months, 2 years, 10, 15, this may not be the church you stay. The Lord, he's going to direct you. He's going to take you places. You're going to get married and go play. Wonderful. But guys, learning, if and as you can, over the long haul, you want to reap rich benefits in a church. I've been here 15 years. The average time in ministry for a pastor, a youth pastor, is about a year and a half. For a pastor, is about 3 years. I feel like in 15 years, we're just getting started. Sweet relationships. I've known some people in this church for 15 years. And we've been through some difficult times. And I tell you, the sweetness of the relationship that is built after work, I mean really difficult times. I don't mean just, you know, pat on the back, ha ha, difficult times. I mean really hard times, and even really relationally hard times, personally. We're still here. And the fruit of that, the richness of that, guys, it's sweet. Anyway, don't grow weary. You will reap later. Don't complain. Romans 12, 16, be of the same mind towards one another. Don't be haughty in mind. Don't be arrogant, but associate with the lowly. Don't be wise in your own estimation. That's always the problem. I'm wise, you're dumb. I'm better, you're worse. I'm good, you're not. Don't be wise in your own estimation. Never pay back evil for evil to anyone. Respect what is right in the sight of all men. If possible, so far as it depends on you, be at peace with all men. That is, on your side, always. Doesn't mean they're going to be at peace with you. You can't make them be at peace with you, but you can't make them an enemy if you choose to be at peace. They can't make you their enemy. Do you understand that? Nobody can make you be an enemy to them. They can treat you like an enemy, but you always have the capacity as a believer to treat them like a friend. Guys, do you understand that? If you knew that and you believed that, then on your side, there would never be anyone in the church at any time or in your family at any time that you weren't friendly towards and in your heart and mind at peace with. Can you imagine that? Even when they're attacking you and harming you and just doing everything they can to be your enemy, it says, as far as it depends on you, be at peace. The context of Romans 12, in that sense, is most likely outside persecution where they were being harmed by other people and they were still at peace with them. You hear testimonies of this, where people are in prison and people have been, you know, taken captive and the guards are harming them and they say, I'm praying for you. I love you. Is that real? Is it some kind of fake weirdness? It's biblical. It's what God does. But should you love some guard who's persecuting you if that were to happen to you? And not love the person on your right or on your left that's sitting here tonight? No, of course not. See, is that we want to be at peace with all men. So far as it depends on you. Well, they don't like me. You love them. Well, they gossip about me. You don't gossip about them and you love them. Well, they cut in on my relationship. You love them. And they're irritating. You love them. Okay, because that's how this works. Don't complain against one another. Don't let the pressure of circumstances cause you to be grumpy, complaining, arguing, murmuring, and then all the way to the serious extent of that towards other people. Why? Because you trust God. Believe that God has put those people in your life. Trust that they are the ones that you are to love, and trust Him as you pursue the means that He gives you to love them well. What a sweet thing when young people love each other well, because nobody expects that. Nobody. They expect you guys to be full of gossip, full of deceit, full of backbiting. That's what they expect. Don't let them get what they expect. Anywhere, at any time. You want to earn respect as a young person? Love others. Love them well. And love this group well. And people will be like, what is that? We're not going to be able to keep them out. Your friends will be like, I have to go to that church because I've never known another group of teenagers who love each other like that. Never. It's not about the cool preaching, the cool events, the nifty camp. It's going to happen when you love each other well. And guys, it's happening. I see it. We just want to cultivate it. That's why we're doing this teaching. All right, the urgency of patience. There is an urgency to this. It's not just oh, it'd be nice if you did this. Do not complain, brethren, against one another. Verse 9, so that you yourselves may not be what? Judged. Now, there's two ways this can be taken, and he goes on to say, behold, the judge is standing right at the door. The judge has got his hand on the door. The eternal judge of all the ages, who will judge our every thought, word, and action, is about to open the door, enter your life, enter the world, and bring his judgment. What's it going to be about your love towards one another, about your not complaining against one another? If he opened the door right now, sat on his throne, brought you before him, and said, youth group, Grace Community Church youth group, one at a time, how's your complaining against one another? Let's look at the video. Now I'm going to ask you and say, hey, tell me. You're going to say, oh, it was good. It was great. I'm wonderful. I was going to say, no, let's look at the video. Every word, every thought, every action, how are you doing? The judge is right at the door. Now, what this will do, one of two things, this judgment. Now, it's a judgment of believers, but the implication is that if you don't have true faith, then you would fail this test entirely and you would be shown to be an unbeliever. Your whole life, the books are open, as it were, and it's all characterized by complaining and a lack of love, which means there was no faith, and so you're not a Christian. That's one way this judgment can be taken. There's another way, though, that the Bible talks about. That's believers being judged in 2 Corinthians 10:5. It says, "For we must all appear before the judgment seat of Christ, so that each one may be recompensed for his deeds in the body according to what he has done, whether good or bad." I don't know exactly how those rewards work. All I know is that there's true recompense. And the things that you did that were grumbling, complaining, lack of love, burned up, gone. The things that you did that were loving and kind and gracious for the purpose of glorifying Christ, there is a reward. The biggest part of that reward, I'm convinced, is the honor of Christ that it brings to have lived a life that was pleasing to him in his power, and he looks great. Think about it. If you didn't love people, you're saying Christ is not great. If you don't love people, you're saying my Savior is weak. If you don't love people, you're saying my Savior isn't worthy of being obeyed. If you don't love people, you're saying my Savior gave the ultimate sacrifice. I'm not gonna. So I think that's probably the greatest reward, is the joy of your master. I think there's, at some levels, the ability to love and have a depth of intimacy with Christ that seemed to be enhanced through a life lived for him now. Not everyone, as we talked about on Sunday, will experience the benefits of intimacy with Christ. It seems like that perhaps some of these benefits will be a stronger, deeper inner man, which is then able to partake and drink even more deeply of the blessings and benefits of heaven. Because you want to hear, well done, right? 1 Corinthians 3:12, now if any man builds on the foundation, that's the foundation that was laid in the church, laid by Christ, and then the apostles, as they built, they wrote scripture and laid the foundation for the church itself. If any man builds on the foundation with gold, silver, precious stones, wood, hay, straw, each man's work will become evident, for the day will show it, because it's to be revealed with fire. The fire itself will test the quality of each man's work. That fire is God's perfection. His judgment upon it, was it pleasing to me? Was it according to scripture? Was it done with a heart that was desired to please me? Which, by the way, as real Christians, you can do. Isn't that neat? You will actually have works that are not burned up. We all say, oh, you know, I can't do anything good. Yes, you can. As a believer, you must. It says, it will test the quality of each man's work. If any man's work which he has built on it remains. Guys, and this is specifically the context of building in the body of Christ. If any man's work which he has built on it remains, he will receive a reward. If any man's work is burned up, he will suffer loss, but he himself will be saved, yet as though by fire. You're in. But you're in with little to show for 60, 70, 50, 40, 30 years on earth. Who would want that? Well, no one. No believer. So the urgency of patience is patience rescues from judgment. Be patient. Don't complain. Learn how to wait on God so you don't take it out on other people. Call out to the Lord when you're wrestling and struggling. Don't complain against other people. And then that's because the judge, number two, is on his way. So the urgency of patience, patience rescues from judgment, and the judge is on his way. Because he's right at the door, as it were. He's about to come at any time. One of the things that might help you is each day as you lay your head down on your pillow or wherever it is that you lay it down, you're thinking through, was I patient today? Did I endure today? Did I have relational courage today? Did I treat my parents kindly and generously? Did I treat my siblings with joy and grace, working through problems with real discussions? Did I invest in the church? Did I speak truth to those around me who are unbelievers? Because you need to make those kinds of evaluations, because believe me, the judge is making them. See, the Lord wants to tell you that nothing you do is judged and that everything you do is fine. That's the biggest lie ever. Everything you do is judged, and it's only fine if it pleases Christ. That's it. And wouldn't it just be nice if you didn't have to worry about judgment? Well, probably not. Because this thought of standing before the one you love and who died for you drives you on towards greater obedience. It's supposed to do that because he's so worthy. And this whole idea of eliminating any kind of impetus, any kind of pressure towards doing what is good and right, the whole world wants to just eliminate that, that's totally idiotic. The one we love drives us a love for him and a longing to please him and experience and know him more and care for his people more drives us on to greater obedience. Yes, there is a pressure to obey more and better all the time. Is it because you're getting saved by that? No. Is it because you're responding to the greatness of your salvation by that? Yes. The judge is on his way. That's a good thing. Believers. And yet we don't want anything that's wasted. Not a word, not a moment, not a time, not camp, not tonight. Because you have, I love youth ministry because I get a chance to tell you this stuff at the beginning. Your parents have already been telling you it since you were like born. I come alongside and say, no, your parents are right because the Bible says that. And then I get a chance to help you do it. It is the sweetest thing ever to put you in positions where you get to do this, to evaluate. And we don't always do it right, but we do our best to try to help you through all of this and say, this is what you need to be before you step out into a world and don't even know this. At least you know this. Let's look at some examples of patience. The examples of patience, that's next. As an example, brethren. So he goes, oh, let's have an illustration. James is full of great illustrations, ships and fires and, you know, horses and all the stuff he does. I love it. He's so good at it. He says, let's use an illustration. But here's just, it's a pretty basic one. He says, as an example, brethren, of suffering and patience. Well, who has suffered a lot in the Bible? Take the, I know, what's the text say? Read it, it's verse 10. Take the prophets who spoke in the name of the Lord. Name me some prophets and something that they suffered. Give me a prophet and something they suffered. Yes, Tirza. All right, they put him down at the bottom of a well, say, we don't want you talking anymore, we're going to kill you when we can. Jeremiah, called him the weeping prophet. What a great name. Wouldn't you like that? Chris Reiser, the weeping pastor. Not cool, I don't want that kind of ministry. Yes. All right, thrown overboard, crunched by a fish, you know, something like that. All right, yeah, that's... Yeah, probably John, except he escaped. But it still wouldn't be cool, he's getting low down. It's probably John, they were boiling him in oil, they couldn't even kill him. So he probably burn marks all over his body. Andrew. Okay. And these are prophets, by the way, right? Because the apostles were also prophets. It doesn't say that in the Bible, but our best understanding is he said, don't crucify me the way my Lord was. I want to be crucified upside down because I don't want to in any way mimic him. Yes. Stephen was stoned. All right. Other apostles, prophets, what did they suffer? That's right. But his brothers ate lunch and then sold into slavery. He was a prophet, by the way. He had prophetic dreams. Okay. Others, other prophets, what did they suffer? Yeah. Into the lion's den, right? And really had a difficult wrestle and struggle in, you know, when he was taken away into captivity, right? 70 people taken into captivity, four of them remain faithful. He's the only one. Guys, we could go on and on. So take the prophet. Look at the Old Testament. Look at Hebrews 11. So turn there. These are some of the prophets and others who spoke in the name of the Lord and who were faithful. Okay, Hebrews 11, everybody there, verse 4. By faith, Abel offered to God a better sacrifice than Cain, through which he obtained a testimony that he was righteous, God testifying about his gifts, and through faith that though he is dead, he still speaks. How did Abel die? He was murdered by his brother, right? That's not a great way to go, right? By faith, Enoch was taken up. Now, Enoch looks like he just got the positive side of things, right? He loved the Lord. God said, boom, I want you with me. You're awesome. You're with me right now. Totally cool. I would love for that to happen to me. So without faith, it's about Noah. Being warned about how did Noah suffer? What's that? Yeah, it's the only way we can know. He's mocked for 100 years. Well, that's a great ministry. How many people did Noah see come to Christ in his ministry? Zero. His family, we don't even know if they were saved, except that God saved them because of him. Possibly they also were. Probably Ham wasn't. Maybe Shem and Japheth were. Maybe their wives, we don't know. So how would you like a 100-year ministry where you were mocked the entire time for building a stupid boat in the middle of nowhere when there probably hadn't been anything that looked like that kind of rain, and then you're telling them, judgment is coming. Like, you're stupid. Now, just think about this. When you tell people judgment is coming now, they call you stupid. But you don't even have the benefit, or you have much more benefit than Noah, because Noah could say, judgment is coming. You go, oh yeah, when has there ever been judgment? And Noah's like, well, never, but it's coming. When you, they say, oh yeah, well, when has there ever been judgment? Oh, remember the thing called the flood? Oh, I don't believe in the flood. Does that mean it didn't happen? I mean, I've got a black truck in my driveway, or actually out here. Do you believe I have one? Well, I don't care if you believe that I have a black truck or not. Is it really there? Am I going to go sit in it? Yeah, so if you say, I don't believe in that, so? It's real. I don't believe in judgment. That makes it not real. I can't see you. This is what little babies do, right? You can't see me because I can't see you. Well, no, it didn't change anything. You didn't disappear. They didn't disappear. Nobody's gone. There is no judgment because I don't think there is. Well, God destroyed the whole world with a flood. By the way, there's evidence all over. of N, worldwide flood, as you would expect. And you could just even point to that kind of evidence as well. Bible's first. I don't believe that. Well, the Bible's true, but you're going to see it all over the world, and there's all kinds of evidences. All right, guys, we could go on. I mean, those are the good things. Actually, let's work our way down. You've got Joseph. You've got, you know, Abraham, right, who had to leave his own country, leave everything he knew, and goes on and on. Moses, who suffered the reproach of Christ. He was kicked out of Egypt and almost killed and all these things. He left it because he didn't want to. He suffered reproach of the people of God instead of the pleasures of sin for a season. Rahab, right, who lost her people, everybody. She got to keep her family because she was faithful. Gideon, Barak, verse 32. Gideon, Barak, Samson, Jephthah, David, Samuel, the prophets, who by faith conquered kingdoms. But then get to verse 36. And others experienced mockings, scourgings, chains, and imprisonment. They were stoned. They were sawn in two. They were tempted. They were put to death with the sword. They went about in sheepskins and goatskins, being destitute, afflicted, and ill-treated, men of whom the world wasn't worthy. Man, that would be a cool epitaph on your grave. A man or woman of whom the world wasn't worthy. Wow. Not a man or woman who's cool. Man or woman who's culturally conformed. Man or woman who's successful. Man or woman who got straight A's. Man or woman who everybody liked. Man or woman of whom the world wasn't worthy. Why? Because you loved Jesus and you served and honored him above all things. It's going to take courage. Take the prophets. They spoke in the name of the Lord. They had God's message, and speaking for him, they were emboldened. Do you have God? Are you a prophet? No. Do you have God's message? Yes. When you speak to people and tell them the truth, you tell them the truth from God's message, right? So you also have the word of the Lord. They spoke in the name of the Lord. You speak according to the truth that's here. And people will hate you for it. And you, by the Lord's grace, will continue to do it because you'll remember David that did it, and Joseph that did it, and Daniel, who as a teenager was sucked away from his home and stood before the king and all of his entourage and said, I won't eat that food because it defiles my God. And you can just imagine how the king, Nebuchadnezzar, in his heart was laughing. I just killed your God. I just destroyed your city, burned your temple, and took his stuff. You have no God. Was he right? No. The world says, I've destroyed your God. There's no God who created. It's all about evolution. The Bible isn't true. We've proved over and over. We've shown, you know, we've seen things in archaeology. All of it says can't be true. There's miraculous stuff in there. We've killed your God. And you look back at them and say, you're crazy. You can't kill God. I'm going to stand. When all the world says, no, God is dead. We killed him. We've done away with him. We don't need your God. Look what we can create. Look what we can do. We can make life. We can turn people into men or women. No, you can't. No, yeah, and you can do amazing, incredible things, but my God is not dead. You take the prophets who spoke in the name of the Lord. You wait. You're patient. You pursue the things of God because God is real and the things he's done are real, and the prophets help prove that to us. It says, we count those blessed who endured. Yeah, Hebrews 11, is there anyone in there that says, well, how about this? By faith, Enoch walked with God for a little while, and then he got discouraged, and he abandoned God and died hating God. No. Okay, not one of them in there. Every one of those. Even a guy like Samson, who at the end of his life, our best understanding is, as he pushes over the pillars, he trusts in God. He believes God at that point, if maybe not before, when he's wandering around, crushing the grain, with his eyes popped out, tied to the donkey's turn thing that turns the mill wheel. Somewhere in there, he trusts God after a life of total pagan debauchery. He trusts God at the end, saved, faith. Didn't fail. Now let's consider Job. Take the prophets, but how about Job? I turn to Job chapter 1. You want a man who had courage in the face of things that you will never face, most likely. It would be hard because you're not going to be as rich as Job, all of you. You're not going to be able to suffer as much as he did. It's just how it goes. All right, Job chapter 1. You know the story. Satan comes before God. God says, have you considered my, where have you been? Wandering on the earth. Have you considered my servant Job? A man is upright, holy, blameless, fearing me. Satan goes, ha! He fears you because you protected him. He fears you because you've given him a lot of stuff. If you take the stuff, he'll curse you to your face. God says, take it. Take it all. Don't touch him. take it all. Now, my prayer is that God will not say that about you, but he might. He might. You might be one whom God says, take it all. Why? Because they have faith that's from me, and that faith will not fail because it can't, because protected says, 1 Peter chapter 1, verse 5, protected by the power of God through faith for salvation ready to be revealed. He says, look, you can take it all from Job. He will not curse me. He will not abandon me because he has faith in me, and I gave him that faith. Now, it doesn't say it all just like that in Job 1, but that's the point of the whole book of Job. Real faith cannot be broken no matter what happens. It's the whole point. God sovereignly allows Satan to do this. So he does. Satan doesn't play. This is a side note. I'm trying not to preach the cross-reference, but I'm telling you this. Satan is evil in the extreme. He's more evil than you could ever imagine. He's only limited by the power of God. If he were not limited by the power of God, then he would destroy everything instantly as much as he could and take everybody to hell now. That's what he would do because he has the power to do that. So when he's given, just to think about this, when he's given power over Job, here's what happens. All right, verse 13 of Job 1. On the day when his sons and daughters were eating and drinking in the house, a messenger came to Job saying, the oxen were plowing, donkeys feeding beside them. The Sabians attacked, took them. They slew the servants with the edge of the sword. I alone. No servants, no more donkeys. Still speaking, another came, the fire of God. That's fascinating. Who actually sent that fire? Satan. All right. And this experience doesn't tell you where things come from, by the way. God gets the overall credit from the sense that he allowed it. But seeing experience and saying, oh, that's from God, watch out. You don't know. Okay, that's the fire of Satan, actually. Again, God's overseeing this, so in that sense, he's the one who has allowed that to happen. But nonetheless, Satan brings it. Satan doesn't play here. He just sends fire down and consumes everything, all the sheep and all the servants. He leaves one. Boom, gone in one flash of fire. While he's still speaking, another one came, verse 17. Chaldeans formed three bands, made a raid on the camels, took them, slew the servants. I alone escaped to tell you. Took everything that he had and the servants. Men did it, right? So fire cult falls, Sabians do it, Chaldeans do it. While I was still speaking, another came and said, here it is, here's the kicker. Your sons and your daughters were eating and drinking wine in their oldest brother's house. A great wind came from across the house. From who? Satan. The wilderness, and it came from the wilderness and the four corners of the house, struck the four corners of the house, fell on the young people, verse 19, they died. I alone have escaped to tell you. Everything is gone. Literally, as nearly as we can tell, the moment God says that, Satan does all that in about 5 minutes. All of it. And if God released Satan's hand today, that is what he would do. That's how evil he is. Kills everyone, everything, as much as possible, and then tortures Job with it. You want to serve that master? You want to serve that father? I don't think so. Turn to God. He's a good, gracious father. And by the way, say, well, how can he be gracious if he let all these things happen to Job? Because he's going to keep Job's faith firm. Job arose, tore his robe. Verse 20, look at it. Everybody look at verse 20. If you were in Job 1. Did you turn there? Anybody? Right. Job arose, tore his robe, shaved his head, and cursed God. No. Okay, if you're reading, you know that's not true. What does it say? He fell to the ground and he worshipped. That's weird. Right? The world would say, you're twisted. Because we know, ultimately, that did come from God's allowance. Satan would never have been allowed to do that to Job had God not set him loose to do it. That's for another day, another sermon, another time to work your way through that. It comes, ultimately, from the hand of God. Job knows this. He doesn't know what's going on in heaven. Right? He doesn't know that. We want to see who he attributes this to. He says, naked I came from my mother's womb. Verse 21, naked I shall return there. Look at this. The Lord gave, the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. Job properly attributed the taking of everything, not to Satan, who actually did the work, but to God, who gives and takes sovereignly and ultimately. No one takes anything that God doesn't allow. No one does anything that God doesn't allow. Like your faith is going to have to be strong. It's going to have to be held by God. It's going to have to be based on the truth of the Word of God. But when it is, it can survive even that. Take heart. By the way, Satan comes back and goes, skin for skin. He only serves you now because you haven't touched his flesh. Now, I just want you to think about, if Satan did that much to Job's stuff, took everything in a moment, left his wife, why? Why? Because he was a pagan who told him to curse God and die. That's why he leaves her. His closest relative, who should be supporting and loving him, says, are you an idiot? Curse God and die. Leaves his friends so his friends can come and taunt him for 35 chapters. All right, not pretty. Takes everything else. Then he says, God says, okay, you can have everything except his life. How much of it do you think Satan took? What kind of sickness do you think that was? How close to death do you think Job was? He was literally, apparently, Satan doesn't give life, but Satan tortured him to the point where he knew exactly where the point would be that it wouldn't kill him, and he took him all the way there. No more cruel torture than that. We don't understand what's going on. It tries to describe it. He's scraping himself with the sword, all that stuff, because we don't even get it. Oh, he's sick. Come on, why is he bummed out about being sick? No, his body was racked and tortured. Everything Satan could possibly do to it, to the point that it didn't kill him, but just up to that. There's no torturer that could ever do that. They go too far. They go that far and you die. They try to do that. There's some people that were tortured by a group of Muslim extremists. They were in Turkey. They got suckered in. These people came into their Bible study and said, hey, we want to learn more about God. So it was two pastors. They went to show them more about God. It was like eight or nine of young people, and they came with towels. Why with towels? And torture devices so they could torture them and then staunch the blood so they didn't die. And they did this for hours and hours and hours, trying to get them just to the point of death, but not killing them. Well, Satan did it perfectly to Job for days. And he sits there in that kind of pain, not having, in this sense, done anything wrong. He was a sinner, I mean, as we all are, but not because he was being punished. And at the end of that, in chapter 2, he continues to serve and honor the Lord. Okay, so he refuses. So he gives honor to the Lord when his wife says, verse 9, his wife says, do you hold fast your integrity, your faith, curse God and die? He said to her, verse 10 of Job 2, you speak as one of the foolish women speaks. Shall we indeed accept good from God and not accept diversity? In all this, Job did not sin with his mouth. Guys, you think you're suffering? Consider Job. He was faithful to the Lord. He did not complain. Now, what we find out is that he had much to say to God. He was wrestling and struggling through this all, but he did not, in that, go over into sinning by refusing to believe that God was good, by ultimately abandoning or rejecting God. His faith was held firm because at the end, God says to the three friends, look, you're judged. Job is going to have to make sacrifices for you because you spoke wrongly about God and he didn't, and Job didn't. It's fascinating to try to read through Job and figure that out. But that's what God says. You spoke wrongly, you three friends, about me. Job didn't. It's amazing. So you guys, that's the example. Your life is not worse than that. Now, I got one more thing to do here. I'm going to talk about the faithfulness of patience. I'm not going to spend much time on this. But back to James. Now, I'm not sure how tightly this is tied to what has come before, this faithfulness of patience. I do think, however, though, since he says, but above all, my brethren, do not swear either by heaven or by earth, I think what is going on here, so it says, don't swear, just keep your word. I think what's going on here is kind of as to summarize all of this. Job is saying, look, or God, through James, is saying, look, don't, when things are difficult, as things are hard, when you see difficult things coming and you're in the middle of it, don't make extreme statements. I swear by so-and-so that I'm going to be faithful. I swear by this that I'm going to do this, which is what we tend to do. When things get extreme, we tend to try to fix it with extreme language. I promise I'll do this, and I'll never do this. And God, if you just do this, I'll do this. I think that's the context here. We tend to go over the top in our language. God, if you'll just, and we make all kinds of sometimes foolish promises about things we will and will not do. And what James says here is, look, stay calm, steady, and faithful. Don't swear you're going to do this and swear you're going to do that. And I swear by the gold in the temple and I swear by whatever that I'm going to do these things. Instead, just do what's right. Your yes is to be yes. Your no is to be no. Don't try to appeal to your righteousness by saying, oh, look at me, I'm going to do this. I swear I'm going to treat you better. I swear I'm going to do this for God. Just do that. Just do that thing. Swear here does not mean don't use a curse word. You're not supposed to do that. It says, let no, in Ephesians chapter 5, let no unwholesome word proceed from your mouth. Ephesians 4. But only such a word is good for edification. Sorry, every curse word ever in any language is undone by that verse. It's an unwholesome word. You're done. No excuse. You can never give me a single excuse ever for anything that's a swear word because it's an unwholesome word. It's viewed by someone as something that's unwholesome. Anyway, that's not what he's talking about. What he's talking about is swearing by, I promise to do this, I'm going to do this, I swear I'll do this. And we don't do that much today. Actually, we know better, but there are people that do it. And sometimes you tend to do it by appealing to things. Okay, I promise I'll do that. He says, don't swear by heaven or by earth or with any of those. What they would do is to look spiritual. It was, I swear by, and they would generally do this by anything less than God, because that would give them a way out of their oath. If they swear by God, they couldn't, you know, they were stuck. But they would swear by the temple or swear by this thing that God made. And in Matthew, we don't have time to go there tonight. In Matthew, Jesus says, what are you doing? God made everything. If you swear by anything, you're swearing by God's name. And so whatever you swear, you'd better do, because God holds you accountable for the things that you swear. It's what I say at every marriage. You are allowed to swear about some things. This doesn't say you can't make an oath about anything. You are allowed to make an oath that says, I will love you in sickness and in health, for richer, for poorer, till death do us part. You are allowed and supposed to say that. And when you do that, you are to keep that vow until death do you part. Because that's a vow made in the eyes of God. So when you do make one, it is in the eyes of God, and you have to keep it. Any promise you ever make. But the bottom line is, you're not supposed to make lots of promises to people. You're just supposed to be faithful. Don't tell them what you're going to do. Just do it. Be faithful. He says, but your yes is to be yes, and your no, no, so that you may not fall under judgment. You're telling other people, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that. Just obey. So, as you think this through, what I'd like you to do is take stock of your personal life in relationship to a faithful, patient endurance. Are you loving people well? Are you waiting upon the Lord? Are you ceasing to grumble? Are you viewing everything from the hand of God as good? Isn't that what James 1 says? Every good and perfect gift is from above, coming down from the Father of lights, with whom there is no variation or shifting shadow. How well are you doing? When you take stock, you may understand, you may see, I'm not a Christian. I don't trust God. I'm not happy with what God is doing. I'm constantly grumbling about my circumstances, my parents, my stuff, everything. I'm constantly grumbling. You may discover that you grumble a lot, but underneath there's a trust in God that you're trying to fan into flame. So you may say, no, I am a believer. I'm going to fan that into flame. And then I want you to think about how you're doing corporately. That is, how are you doing in relationship to others? With this grumbling and complaining against one another, with this being patient as a family. And then for those of you who are going to camp, I would say, why don't you set a goal that this would be the best family experience ever, because you would take this to heart and be patient in your relationship. If you're not going to camp, you've got plenty of times to do it, plenty of places, right? Plenty of things in your family, and then the rest of the year here if you're coming. All right, let's pray. Father, thank you for this powerful word. Thank you for your reminder to us that you are faithful to us. That even when incredibly difficult things happen, like happened to Job, your power will hold our faith strong. And I pray for these young people that they would be patient until the coming of the Lord, that they'd have relational courage, that they would love each other well, and as a result, that many would come to Christ, and that they would be strengthened, that you would be honored, and that their life would be a one that is one of which the world is not worthy. In your precious name, Lord Jesus. Amen. All right, no small groups or anything like that, so you can play frisbee or